Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. During the 2004 Democratic presidential race, Howard Dean's campaign revolutionized the use of the internet to raise money and organize volunteers. Recently, Dean told me that when he launched his campaign, he had no idea how important the internet would be in his bid to win the Democratic nomination.
That was absolutely not any part of my strategy whatsoever. What Joe Tripi provided was a window into this new generation, and he would hire almost anybody that was on the internet that knew something about how to run the internet. So they all came, and half of them didn't even get hired. They slept on floors and worked for nothing. They were the ones that redesigned everything.
Nick O'Mealy was the webmaster of the Dean campaign. He's written a new book entitled The End of Big: How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. It looks at how the technological changes of the past decade are having an enormous impact on virtually every aspect of our lives, from politics to entertainment to the role of the military. He's currently a faculty member at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and he's our guest today on Vermont Edition. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can always post your comments at Vermont Edition's page at vpr.net. You can go to Vermont Edition's Facebook page. You can tweet us at Vermont Edition. And email works just fine as well, vermontedition@vpr.net. How do you think technology has changed our world over the past 10 years? Have these changes resulted in challenges to big institutions? And do you worry that companies like Google and Facebook are sharing your information for commercial purposes? Are you concerned that your smartphone is tracking your specific location almost all of the time? Are there some privacy issues here? Or is it way too late to deal with this situation? And what kind of technological changes will take place over the next 10 years, and how will they affect our lives? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Nico, before we discuss your book, I want to go back to 2003 and the story of how you got involved in the presidential campaign of a long-shot candidate from a small New England state. Now, Howard Dean tells the story of going to a meetup event on the Lower East Side of New York City. He gets stuck in traffic several blocks from the site, and in utter frustration, he gets out of the cab to walk to the remaining distance. And when he gets there, he realizes there's a traffic jam because so many people want to come see him. And he's absolutely astonished by this development. And as fate would have it, you were also headed to that meetup event. Briefly explain to us how you went from working in New York City to being the webmaster on the Dean presidential campaign.
It is amazing to me that it was a decade ago, a little over a decade ago now. It was in March of 2003. I was living in New York. I had spent a number of years working in Washington, D.C., and had been around politics. I had not worked on any political campaigns. I'd volunteered a little here or there. But I've been around politics enough to know that that far out, to have that kind of crowd at an event, was really unusual for American politics. I did not. A friend of mine had invited me and said, "Oh, hey, you really would love this guy Howard Dean. You should come hear him speak." And I couldn't even get in to the venue to hear him speak. I stood outside on the sidewalk and I was talking to people and I was just watching the energy of it. And I thought, there was something exceptional happening here. But at first, I didn't do much about it. The next morning, I went home. I didn't hear him speak. I can't even remember what I did. But the next morning, I got up and went to work. And I decided, oh, you know, I'll give him a little bit of money. That'll be my, you know, that'll be my thing for the underdog. There's something happening there, and that needs to be encouraged. I definitely felt then, and still to some extent feel like, American politics is relatively moribund these days. And so I went online to try and find his website, and I couldn't find it. It was not deanforpresident.com. It was not dean04.com. It was not howarddean.com. And Googling wasn't helping. I finally found it, and it was deanforamerica.com. And I ended up buying a Google ad so that when you Googled the words Howard Dean, a little ad popped up that said the official website of Howard Dean, deanforamerica.com. And instead of giving him money, I bought that ad and I thought, oh, that's my contribution to his race. And I forgot about it. And then probably 2 or 3 weeks later, I got my credit card bill. And it was gigantic. This thing that had started out every day as like a very small, I don't even remember, like it was like $20 of clicks, had skyrocketed. It was like a hockey stick. It had just in 3 weeks gone from 0 to 10,000. It was just shooting up. And so I called the campaign. And I remember I waited on hold for quite a long time. And then finally I spoke to someone, a woman named Zephyr Teachout. And I remember the first thing she said is, I wondered who was running those ads. Huh. And then I said to her, well, listen, I can't afford to do this anymore. I'll pay this bill, but this is it. But you should really do this. You could probably raise some money. And she said, well, no one here knows how to do that. If you want to do that, then you should move up here and do it. And
That's incredible.
I thought, oh, that's a little crazy. And I remember hanging up and thinking, oh, I'm not going to do that. But then I think it was like my boss yelled at me. And then I had just broken up with my girlfriend. And I went home and I thought, I always wanted to work on a presidential campaign. And this guy Howard Dean is talking very differently than most of the other people in the race. And there had just been New York Magazine had just come out with the first real profile of his presidential race. And I read it and I thought, that's it. I'm going to move to Vermont and do this.
So when you moved to Vermont, did you have sort of the grand plan unfolding in your mind, or was it kind of learned by doing on a day-to-day basis?
There was no grand plan, not by a long shot. It was flying by the seat of our pants. It was, you know, building the airplane as we were getting altitude. And it was enormous fun. It was incredibly exciting. It was unbelievably stressful and miserable. It was absolutely the single best and single most terrifying experience of my life. And you know, what can I say? There was a moment when we started to try and think very carefully about how could we be. This was happening already. This was blowing up every day. What was happening for Howard Dean on the internet was just skyrocketing. And at some point we started to think, oh, we should be more intentional about this. How should we channel this energy? What kinds of things should we do that would make it grow even exponentially greater? And we started looking around for models. And luckily, you know, MoveOn.org had been around for a few years already and provided a pretty compelling online fundraising model, which we just applied to a presidential campaign for the first time.
Our guest today on the program, Nick O'Mealy, he is the author of the book, The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. He was the webmaster at the Dean presidential campaign. 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you today. So I'm wondering, Nico, if your experience with the Dean campaign really highlights, you know, sort of the premise of your book, that a small, technologically savvy operation can compete with the mainstream Goliath candidates and really have some impact on the system.
Absolutely. You know, part of the thesis of my book grew out in part of thinking about the 2008 presidential campaign. Here was Obama, an insurgent candidate, a guy who'd been in public life less than a decade when he decided to run for president, who beat Hillary Clinton. And, you know, Bill and Hillary Clinton really built the modern Democratic Party. And the notion that she could lose was unthinkable, and yet she did. And as I was, you know, after that election, when I was really kind of thinking about it and digesting it and thinking, I wonder, was there anything Hillary could have done to have defeated Obama. And I'm sure people come up with things, but I just began to think about tactically the role that technology plays in empowering insurgents. And one of my conclusions was that the technology really levels the playing field in a significant way for institutions, especially when big institutions or established candidates or established brands and companies, when they're not doing a good job, the technology gives people a very easy way to disrupt, to opt out, to try something new. And that creates a range of fantastic, exciting opportunities and also scary, terrifying disruptions.
So when we look at something like a big institution like Congress that is really tied up in gridlock these days, do you think technology has an opportunity in our political system to have an alternative to what's happening in Congress, perhaps to help fuel some more local movements?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's happening already. I think that the on two fronts. One front is that, and part of the argument I make in my book, I have a chapter on big political parties. And I talk about how the two major parties had really grown into like cocktail parties for major donors over the last 25 years, not grassroots parties. Figuring out where your local Democratic or Republican Party meeting is, in many places, is very near impossible to figure out when and where it is. And so these parties that used to be really grassroots organizations and farm teams, like that help find new leaders and cultivate them and grow them and prepare them for higher office, they'd become really these really fundraising networks for major donors, for the wealthy people in America to fund our politics. And so that failure made them easy to disrupt. Once you could figure out how to raise money online, like we did with Howard Dean and like Barack Obama did, it was pretty easy to disrupt the establishment political party. And people's frustration with the political parties is evident in the fact that Obama managed to defeat Hillary. It's also evident in the last 4 years where over a dozen U.S. Senate races in the primaries, the Republican establishment candidate has lost to a Tea Party candidate. The Tea Party is part of what's creating gridlock in Congress. But I see that as more of a symptom of a deeper sickness with our political system, a deeper frustration that led to the ability of these Tea Party candidates to get elected, to defeat Republican establishment candidates. When I look at the way Congress itself works, I just think it doesn't make much sense anymore. I mean, we vote on Tuesday because Sunday is church day and Monday is market day, and we ride our horse and buggy into town to vote on Tuesday. We have 435 members of the House of Representatives because in the like 30s, they figured that's how many seats comfortably fit in the room, even though the size of the average House district has exploded, especially in the last 40 years. So I just think that the system and pace of our institutions, especially of our government and Congress, are just completely out of sync with the reality of our society and the velocity of our technology.
Let's go to our listeners and talk to Anne in Heartland. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm really happy you're doing this show, and it's very refreshing to hear a optimistic take on the future. I was just wondering whether your guest had read Cypherpunks by basically talking about the problems with privacy, which I guess is the second half of your show. But I was just wondering whether you'd read Cypherpunks by Applebaum. His last name's Applebaum. I'm blocking his first name.
Yeah, I have not. It's Julian Assange from WikiLeaks who wrote it with Jacob Applebaum and a couple other co-authors. And I actually, funny you should mention it, I just started reading it this week and I haven't finished it yet. But I do think it's an exceptional take on privacy. I mean, we're living in a moment where I don't think we can keep secrets. That, you know, sometime in the 70s, a group of computer scientists were arguing about what is a file, what should be fundamental attributes of a file. And one of the things they decided is that files should be copied. and that you should be able to copy a file without permission of the file's creator at no cost and with zero loss. And so anything, any digital file can be copied. It's built into our file systems. And that means that it's pretty hard to create secrets. And that also means it can be pretty hard to have any privacy. The openness and the accessibility that's built into our technology in some ways has made some of these decisions already. And the questions I want to raise in my book is not whether or not that's a good thing, because I think it simply is, and more, what does that mean for leadership? What does that mean for decision making? What does that mean for government? I think that a central purpose of government, not the only purpose, but a central purpose of government, is to allow leaders and diplomats and members of Congress to allow decisions to be made behind closed doors, to have some negotiating, to have some secrets, and that kind of secrecy is dangerous for power. And that one of the purposes of government is to provide accountability and integrity so that you can have those discussions behind closed doors, so that you can keep some secrets in a democracy, but we can have vehicles for accountability and integrity so that power does not totally corrupt. And I think that what we're looking at is this two different threads colliding. One is the technology bringing a radical kind of transparency to our leaders and institutions. And at the same time, our institutions having done a phenomenally bad job, having been pretty unaccountable and really beyond the pale in many instances. And so that's a collision where we began to navigate with WikiLeaks, and we're navigating again with Snowden and the NSA. And I will just point out that's a situation I expect we all have to get used to, not just at the federal government level and about national security, but in our high schools and elementary schools, in our local communities. There is a radical kind of transparency that the technology is bringing to the present moment that is not always useful, but is a reality.
Today on the program, our guest is Nico Mealy. The book, The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. What do you think about these technological changes, perhaps the lack of privacy going forward? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Nico Mealy. His book, The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Let us know what you think of privacy issues, the kinds of technological changes that could take place over the next 10 years. We were talking about WikiLeaks. Is it a good, a bad thing, or is it just the reality of the future? 1-800-639-2211. Nico, I just want to go back to this privacy issue for a second. Do you think most people who are using all sorts of new technology really understand that all this personal information that companies like Google or Facebook are gathering on them, that a lot of this personal information is out in the open being used for commercial purposes? Do you think people know that, and should they be concerned about that?
I think people do know that. I think that our attitudes about privacy are just shifting, and shifting fairly dramatically. And in fact, they historically, our attitudes about privacy have been in flux, you know, before. This is just a moment when they're changing again. I do think that despite the fact that our attitudes about privacy as a society are changing, there are some things that don't make sense. You know, you have these like 60-page terms of service agreements when you're using these services. You just click yes. Nobody reads them. And that's a pretty bad way to do this. That doesn't make sense. That doesn't protect our interests as consumers, our interests as citizens. It certainly, I think, is a disservice to us in that sense. But I also think it's bad for these companies. It's not the kind of relationship they should have with their customers. And so we're not – we don't have sophisticated ways of navigating privacy and even understanding the extent to which we've lost it. It's a real challenge of the digital age, one that I talk a little bit about in the book. The book is much broader, but privacy is part of the issues we're confronting here. We need some new institutions, some new ways of navigating this, new ways of thinking about it. The old ways aren't working. The terms of service agreements make no sense. You know, I think that Americans generally, a part of the shift in our attitudes about privacy is a willingness to willingness to live in a different age of privacy, provided that there's some accountability. One of the interesting things is that about this whole NSA flap is that Americans, by and large, weren't necessarily that upset that the government was watching everything. They were upset that there wasn't real accountability about that, that there wasn't some check or management on that power, that the head of the NSA was evasive into the Senate Intelligence Committee. That's supposed to be some of the accountability process. Just today on BostonGlobe.com, Judge Mark Wolf is calling for a cabinet-level secretary of civil liberties so that the public interest in accountability on these issues can be kept at that level and advocated for at that level directly to the president. We need to figure out some new ways of navigating this because the old ways aren't making any sense and they're not working and there'll be consequences.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Reg in Bennington. Hi, Reg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm calling and it ties right in with what your guest was just saying about the privacy and accountability aspects. A few minutes ago, you mentioned the idea that there was a need for secrecy in terms of discussing things, say, in Congress, or last night I was hearing on the news about Secretary of State Kerry's negotiations process in the Middle East between the Palestinians and Israel, and saying that he has to keep his mouth shut and keep it quiet, because otherwise each side would face political ramifications that would force them to dig their heels in and wouldn't allow them to actually discuss realities in exchanges. And I think we realize that that's a given fact. But I'm concerned when you get into situations like, say, the trade agreements, like the Pacific trade agreement, where it seems that the power is not counterbalanced. And so you have huge corporate interests sitting down with the government, but the public is totally unaware. And again, you can argue, like in the Middle East, well, you need that kind of thing. But I think this is more evidence of the combined power of corporations, large corporations, not the little guys or the middle-sized ones, and governments that are no longer being balanced by, say, trade unions or a really delving in press. The press has become, and I use press in a broad sense of radio, television, and communications, which has really become more of a evening talk show kind of thing. I don't think it is serving to support the state as it should.
I would say that the I agree in many respects. I think that my point about privacy and secrets in government is that that leadership requires some closed door deliberation, and yet our technology seems to work against that. And the key in allowing decisions and negotiations behind closed doors is having process that gives that integrity, that holds that accountable to the public interest. And when you're talking about these trade agreements, I'm not an expert, but you may be right that there's not a broader accountability to the public interest in the way those things are done. So we absolutely need systems that provide integrity and that represent the public interest. I think broadly our institutions have done a pretty terrible job. You know, if you're under 40 in this country, the odds are pretty good, much better than even, that your quality of life and your standard of living is lower than your parents. Just a cover of USA Today last week. If you're under 40 in this country, you probably can't afford to buy a home. Certainly not a home as nice as the one your parents bought at the same age. Across the board, if we look at education and student loan debt, if we look at jobs, retirement options across and healthcare across the board, you know, there's a compelling case to be made that certainly people under 40 are worse off than their parents were at the same age. And I think that speaks to a tremendous failure of our institutions in this country. And the technology provides both a great opportunity to reform and change those institutions, a vehicle for disrupting them and for building new institutions, but it also can simply disrupt. And the point and force and thrust of my book is that we can't just let it disrupt. We must build some new ways of doing this. We have to both fix some of these old institutions and in some cases start wholly new ones. Take the press. You mentioned the media. You know, the vast majority of the accountability investigative journalism in this country is done via newspapers. And yet the business model for newspapers, 80% advertising, 20% subscription. You know, if you want to get the sports scores, you also have to buy the front page. That business model just doesn't make sense in the digital age. And I'm not sure it's going to persist. And yet I believe that investigative journalism, that journalism, accountability journalism, is essential to the function of the country, is essential to healthy communities, is essential to holding power accountable. And so we have to figure out some new vehicles for that. And it may not look like newspapers, but we got to figure out some new vehicles, some new institutions that take advantage of the technology, but also carry the hard-won values that got us to where we are today.
Our guest today is Nico Amelie. The book, The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. We've got a few moments left. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You know, one interesting part of the book that fascinated me, Nico, was that you don't necessarily believe that all these technological changes that we're seeing are necessarily a positive thing. You seem to have some concerns in some areas. What concerns you the most?
Boy, that's a hard one. I think what concerns me the most is a kind of creeping narcissism. Our technology radically empowers individuals. You know, I'm fond of saying that if you have a smartphone, an iPhone, or an Android, a BlackBerry, that is probably as powerful or even more powerful than a Cray supercomputer circa 1975. And so in 35 years, we've gone from computers that might fill a room and only really be available to the world's largest institutions, big universities, big companies, big government, to Americans carrying them around in their pockets, 130 million Americans to be exact. And you can go into any strip mall in America and buy a smartphone. That is a tremendous devolution of power. That's a diffusion of power. That's pushing power from the institution to the individual. And it really it gives individuals an enormous amount of power that is expressed in a wide range of ways through social media, through, everything from Facebook to Instagram to Twitter to blogging to apps like Uber to great apps that allow for car sharing and resource sharing and all kinds of great stuff. But it also places a lot of emphasis on the individual, on the person. And that kind of narcissism is not even quite the right word, but that kind of self-indulgence, it worries me greatly in a civic sense of what that means for communities and also what that means for relationships and for intimacy. Sherry Turkle is a professor at MIT who has an excellent book on the subject titled Alone Together, that you can be with a group of people and everyone can be on their phones. And so you can be physically together but emotionally quite alone. And there's a little bit of a paradox there because you can also be very physically alone, and yet emotionally very much a part of a community online. And so it's navigating that, navigating what that means for who we are as people and who we are as a society that I care most about. I believe that I want the technology to demand our best self and consequently our best communities. And I think the technology right now makes that very, very challenging.
We've got a minute or two left. I'm wondering, you talked about how for people under 40, the economy is not as strong as it was for their parents. Well, you know, there's some people who are shut out of the sort of technological revolution. There's a digital divide. How can that play out? And are we setting up a situation where we have the haves and the have-nots?
I mean, I think that the reality is that technology is more widely available than ever before. That even you might say knowledge is more widely available than ever before. And there certainly are significant and important and crucial concerns about the digital divide, especially outside the United States, and a gap between the rich and the poor countries. But I also think that the technology kind of paradoxically opens as much opportunity as it does while also, you know, growing the gap. Now, for the first time in human history, anywhere in the world, if you can get on the internet, you can really self-educate at an astonishing speed, depth, and breadth. And that's an exciting thing. That availability of knowledge is exceptional. You know, MIT is putting every course they have on the internet. That's an astonishing moment and opportunity. And I do think that quite kind of maybe too narrow, but we do in the United States, the speed and quality of your internet connection is very much determined by how much you can afford to pay for it.
That's
and
right.
That is very, very troubling.
Fascinating subject. We're running out of time, but Nick O'Malley, many thanks for being on the program today. The book, The End of Big, a fascinating read. Thanks very much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for your calls.
Coming up next, I'll talk with Congressman Peter Welch about his concerns about government surveillance programs. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The U.S. House this week considered legislation that imposes new restrictions on the intelligence-gathering operations of the National Security Agency under the Patriot Act. The bill would have required the NSA to show probable cause to a special federal intelligence judge before it can monitor phone calls, emails, or social networking sites of Americans. The bill didn't pass, but the vote was close, 217-205. And it marked one of those rare times that this issue has been openly debated in Congress. With us now to discuss this issue is Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
So you strongly supported this new legislation. Why? Why did you think this bill was needed?
Well, there's two things. One, we have to acknowledge the need for security, but we also have to acknowledge the need to protect our constitutional rights. That's the point of the Constitution. The reason I believe it was necessary is that the NSA, we gave them an inch and they took a mile. I mean, essentially, without any public discussion, without any awareness by Congress, they set up a data bank that basically had everybody's emails and logs of all their telephone conversations. Number one, if they're going to do that, why in the world are not Americans told that that is the plan? And all of that information is there. Keep in mind, some social websites have a lot of information about people, but the government has the power to indict. It has the power to prosecute. So it's very important that we remember that we can be secure and preserve our constitutional rights. That's the bottom line. And there has been virtually no congressional discussion or debate, and there's been a total lack of transparency. That was one of the reasons I think many people voted for that bill. It was a statement that says, yes, we need security, but you know what? Let's not keep the American people in the dark.
The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Mike Rogers, says the existing Patriot Act, quote, has thwarted numerous terrorist attacks against the United States and its allies. Clearly, it has saved American lives. So if that's the case, how do you respond to criticism that you're taking a big risk by making it more difficult for the NSA to track potential terrorists?
Well, one of the difficulties with assessing that is that none of the members of Congress know what the specifics are. So you can expect that the intelligence community is going to make assertions and claims about what has been done, but you've got to kick the tires to see whether that happens. Keep in mind the NSA budget is largely secret. It's like over $30 billion. But members of Congress don't have any opportunity to review how things are being spent, whether the money spent is actually worthwhile. You know, this PRISM program, which was the collection of all the emails and telephone records, that's like done by a company that has $6 billion in revenues, like 95% of it from the taxpayer. And how do we assess whether they're pushing product and making profit versus actually doing something that is useful? So there's, in my view, there's not just a constitutional question, there's a taxpayer accountability question. Are we getting our money's worth? And I think significance of this vote, where you had a big number of Republicans and Democrats, is saying that we, as members of Congress representing people in Vermont and around the country, have to be brought into this discussion, have to be brought into this debate, so that that balance between security and constitutional rights, we get it right.
I also saw this comment from Texas Representative Mac Thornberry, quote, I'm afraid there may be a fair number of members who don't really understand this issue. The NSA has more scrutiny by judges and by members of Congress than just about any other federal program you can name. But are you saying that the oversight isn't good enough?
Yeah, I'm absolutely saying that. I mean, the FISA court is totally secret. The decisions they make are totally secret. The evidence that we have indicates that it essentially is a rubber stamp for the security of the folks that come in asking for approval. So when something is done completely in the dark, then obviously you're not going to be able to assess it, and you're keeping the American people in the dark. And, you know, you see in governmental agencies and a lot of other places that if you give authorization to do something, people will take it right up to the brink and then pass. So accountability is a good thing, even in intelligence. And keep in mind, those of us who are saying that we need accountability and more transparency, we're totally in favor of keeping secret a specific investigation or keeping secret a source or a method by which our security forces operate. That stuff has to be secret so they can be successful in their job. But in this broad policy about how we're spending taxpayer money, about whether we're going to have a system where all of our emails and all of our telephone logs are in the government control, that really has to be made public to the American people. They're entitled to know that, and it's important to have that debate and discussion so it's not a one-way street all on the side of security and at the expense of constitutional rights.
So this was a close vote. Do you see this issue coming up again?
Here's the good news with that. The message has been sent loud and clear that Congress and, by the way, the American people have to be brought into this discussion and debate. What I found most astonishing about the PRISM program was, why was it secret? You know, some Americans might be okay with that, but they should know that the government is collecting a data bank of all these phone logs and emails. So I think that the upside of this vote, even though we lost, is that the administration gets it, that we have to have a serious discussion involving Congress and, more importantly, the American people.
You were also involved this week in an effort to require the Obama administration to get the specific approval of Congress before providing military aid to anti-government forces in Syria. You had an amendment ready to go, but the House Rules Committee rejected it as part of the debate over the defense appropriations bill. Why did you try to offer this amendment?
Chris Gibson, a Republican in 20-year veteran of military service, he's from New York, and I offered the amendment. Number one, we have questions about the wisdom of the policy of arming rebels. I mean, this Syrian civil war is just an ongoing fight between Sunni and Shia sectarian factions. And as heartbreaking as it is, and I was at a Syrian refugee camp, and your heart does break, does arming the rebels lead to an effective outcome? It won't change the military balance. That's a very token gesture, but with significant implications. And number two, it risks that a step of Americanizing the Civil War. But secondly, and really fundamentally, if America is going to engage in an act of war and arming rebels to take down a government, is that? Shouldn't Congress have to stand up, each one of us, and say yes or no, so that people will know where we stand? And Congress has been too lenient on essentially outsourcing its constitutional Article I responsibility to be the one that decides on war to the executive. So I found it quite astonishing that we were not even given an opportunity to take the responsibility to vote yes or no on arming the Syrian rebels.
Well, there's some members of Congress and members of the administration who argue that your amendment would really tie the hands of the administration from being able to react quickly to changing developments on the ground in Syria. Do they have a point?
Well, they don't. You know, it's a point, but here's another point. There's a constitutional requirement that Congress deal with a war-making decision. And, you know, there's a question here about whether what role we should be playing in Syria. And whatever that decision is, it should not be something we stumble into where one step leads to another, and inevitably we find ourselves in another Iraq or another Afghanistan. This is the moment when a critical decision is being made. And this is the time, tough as that decision may be, where each of us in Congress, who has an incredible responsibility when it comes to a war and peace decision, we should be held accountable, and we can't be held accountable if we don't even debate and then vote on approving this action.
Instead of your amendment, I think a plan was adopted that calls on the administration to, quote, consult with Congress before taking military action. Is this a step in the right direction, or is it essentially worthless?
It's really tokenism. You know, it did. I spoke on it. I voted for it. But what that amendment says is that the administration has to comply with the War Powers Act. So we're passing a law that basically says that the president has to obey the law that already exists. So it was a way, essentially, of pretending that we did something when we actually avoided doing the job that we're required to do and vote on something meaningful.
Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
The EPA approved the state's clean water program. Strolling of the Heifers agreed to buy Brattleboro's River Garden. Congressman Welch called for veterans to have better access to their medical records. State revenue forecasts are recovering slowly, and the Green Mountain Power Corporation was ordered to cut wind output as power demands peaked. These were some of the voices in the news this week.
Concern is that our state law basically makes compliance with the Clean Water Act contingent on state and federal money being provided, and EPA made it clear that that is a straightforward and plain violation of the Federal Clean Water Act.
We have the infrastructure and the logistics to create events here that will really support the community and provide some income. We want to have a lot of farm-to-plate dinners here. I also want to promote the food producers of Vermont.
The kind of hassles that this has created for our veterans, trying to get the medical attention that they need, trying to have an adjudication of their disability benefits, basically trying to get good care, is brutal, and it's also unconscionable.
At this phase of the business cycle, we'd usually be looking at a much more vigorous recovery. We'd normally be having accelerating rates of growth, and we're not. And the reason is the headwinds that exist from federal fiscal policy.
They had coal plants going, they got everything going. They're running peaking oil units, some of the most costly polluting things to do, and then they're curtailing some wind. It's kind of crazy.
Links to these stories are at vpr.net. That's our show for today. Monday, we'll hear about a select group of athletes for whom running 26.2 miles is just not enough. The ultra marathoners. They enter events to run 50 or 100 miles and sometimes even more. It takes a dedicated individual and special training to compete in these races, and we'll hear about them on Monday. If you have any questions or comments about ultra marathons, or if you would compete in them yourself, write us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition's producers are Patty Daniels, Rickson Gary, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Annie Pruitt and Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.